From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Sam Harris is known most for his best-selling book, The End of Faith. A neuroscientist who is also author of Letter to a Christian Nation, he recently published The Moral Landscape, which provides answers to the essential question of whether or not science can determine human values. Sam Harris joins us in studio in the hour ahead. We'll include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Sam Harris joins us in studio for this forum hour, a Stanford and UCLA trained neuroscientist. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The End of Faith, which won the Penn Award for Nonfiction, and Letter to a Christian Nation. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Times of London, the Boston Globe, Newsweek, Foreign Policy, and the Annals of Neurology. And he's co-founder and chairman of Project Reason. His newest book is called The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values. He joins us in studio for the second hour, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. We heard you recently on Science Friday. Quite a panel that was, you and Steve Pinker, and it was fascinating to listen to.
I'm glad. I had a fight with Simon Blackburn, I think.
And it was fascinating. Yeah, we might have a fight, too, in the course of this hour.
Okay.
But I am an admirer of yours, and I guess I want to get right to what you bring up in this new book, which is a relation of knowledge and values. And since you've been so identified with kind of the anti-faith camp, one has to ask, is science really a prescriptive way to get to values? And you seem to say, indeed, it is.
Yeah. I think the first thing I should point out is I don't define science narrowly. I think science really is just our best effort to honestly represent our knowledge about the way the world works. So science in principle includes any discipline where we are actually talking about facts and relying on clear observation and honest reasoning. So history and economics, I mean, this is part of our scientific worldview. So you ask a question.
The softer sciences, as they call
them. Yeah. I'm not by no means a hard science snob, but I think we have to be very careful to distinguish when we are making honest claims about the nature of reality and when our conviction in our beliefs is actually scaling with the evidence and the argument, and when we are deluding ourselves and our children about things we clearly don't know. And I think the onus is certainly on religion in that latter regard, that religion is made of a kind of discourse where people give one another permission to believe things strongly without evidence or without sufficient evidence or, in fact, in contradiction to mountains of evidence. And we call that faith, and faith is elevated to some kind of necessary and redeeming principle of life. And I think that is that's a pathology in our intellectual landscape, and it's something that I, as you know, have reacted against.
You've just nicely crystallized a good deal of your thinking, and I want to get into this with religion. But where is the place with all the emphasis on rationality, empirical data, reason, science and learning values and learning morality, where does intuition and imagination, or what my colleague and friend Jacob Needleman calls the inner empiricism, come in, or does it come in?
Yeah, well, it does come in. Intuition is at the core of every intellectual endeavor. There are mathematical intuitions, there are physical intuitions. Some of our intuitions are wrong, and yet we only correct them by virtue of using other intuitions which appear to be right. So we get around the bugs in human cognition by relying on other mechanisms. And science is the area where we have brought this to really an exquisite kind of precision, where people are systematically correcting for their biases and their wishful thinking and their self-serving reasoning. And it's a culture where it's really the only culture in which you win points for proving yourself wrong, and where people show an aptitude for not being wrong for longer than they can help it. And you don't see this in so many other areas of life. But to come to this question of how this relates to morality, I think morality and human values clearly relate to questions of human and animal well-being. And because human and animal well-being are emerging out of the way the universe is, which is to say they're tightly constrained by the laws of nature, then clearly there are going to be right and wrong answers to the question of how human beings, for our case, can thrive. And these right and wrong answers have to be understood at some point within the context of science, broadly speaking.
Well, broadly speaking, science tells us that human and animal well-being might imply that we shouldn't eat meat for environmental reasons as well as other reasons, that we shouldn't drive cars, that we shouldn't drink liquor or have abortions. I mean, all of these things sort of fall into that orbit, don't they?
Well, yeah, there are trade-offs, clearly. I think, to take a specific example of eating meat, the question for me is there more suffering occasioned by the eating of meat than would be the case if we eliminated it? And I think you could certainly make an argument. I mean, it's not by no means an easy answer. I think we are right to be more concerned about the happiness of people than about the happiness of cows, and more about cows than about insects, because I think we're right to feel that the possibilities of well-being and the possibilities of suffering do scale in some linear way with the complexity of a nervous system. So I don't think the radical animal rights groups are giving us a sane position here. We can't respect the well-being of all species equally. And this is not just because we're humans and we naturally care more about ourselves. We are right to care about the greatest swings in happiness and suffering in this universe. And we know those swings aren't taking place in ants and crickets. And we know they're not taking place in cows to the degree that they are in human beings.
Have you read Ed Wilson? I'm not sure about the ants.
Well, I don't think he wouldn't say that they experience a rich subjective life. But I disagree with Ed Wilson on a few things.
I imagine you do. And I disagree with you on a few things. Let's get into that because people know, I suppose I have a book out on agnosticism. And Sam Harris is our guest. He has a book out called The Moral Landscape, which is a book about, as the subtitle says, how science can determine human values. If we're going to quantify things on the basis of suffering and human happiness, if you're going to use that equation, there are many people who are happy because they have faith. And there are many people who use faith as a way of providing solace and comfort. I mean, this is an argument that I've made. And the other thing that strain that comes in here is that faith can provide people with ways out of addiction, has historically, provides people ways out of recidivism. So, in other words, you don't need faith to live a moral life. Let's get that out of the
way.
And there's terrible carnage and horror and stupidity done in the name of faith. So we put those things aside. Still, faith gives people great comfort and solace and happiness.
Yeah, I wouldn't dispute that. I think
ameliorate suffering. Yeah.
Yeah. The problem is that faith gives people bad reasons to be good and happy where good reasons are available. And there is this consequence of having your beliefs not track reality in an honest way, which is dogmatic beliefs are intrinsically divisive. We have a world that has been shattered by these competing worldviews where we have Christians against Muslims, against Jews, against Hindus. And because their core beliefs are not anchored to an open and searching and honest dialogue about the nature of reality, but they're anchored to preserving a dialogue that occurred thousands of years ago and now exists only in holy books. These worldviews, we can't fuse our cognitive and moral horizons through conversation because every group has a core belief or many that are non-negotiable through acknowledging new arguments and new evidence. And this is the antithesis of what we're doing in science.
Those beliefs change depending on the person who is holding fast them. I was thinking, for example, when you mentioned the different religions of how, you know, we have these three great icons and martyrs, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Malcolm X. Malcolm X, after he did the Hajj and went to Mecca and said, you know, they're not white devils anymore, we can worship together. That's a kind of more ennobling sense of religion, a more compassionate view, and a more all-embracing view that tries to, again, ameliorate suffering.
Yeah, but look at how these beliefs change. Let's take a concrete example. When the Catholic Church finally rescinds its dogma about contraception, which I think it will at some point because it's too idiotic and harmful for words, who's going to get the credit? I mean, is that going to be evidence that the Catholic Church has these internal resources of wisdom that have finally borne fruit in this kind of most basic commitment to human flourishing? Or will all of the criticism that has come from the outside and will continue to come in the face of this really criminal negligence and ignorance on the part of this institution, will that get the credit? And I think it's pretty clear that the credit should go to outside the institution and outside the faith. And I think that is true everywhere you can point to the moderating influence of modernity on Iron Age philosophy, which is what we're talking about. So I think it's – so when you look at moderate Muslims and moderate Christians who have learned to ignore the most barbarous passages in their holy books, what you're looking at is a bowdlerization of the faith and a forced edit based on the fact that hewing too narrowly to the faith makes life unlivable in the modern world, and for good reason.
But there's still an undergirding of faith. In fact, I was thinking about when you write in your book about Scandinavian countries and how won't they are to pretty much abandon faith. They still have ritual. They still have christenings. They still have weddings. They still go through, you know, Christian rituals in a very almost peremptory way.
Yeah, well, I think we need ritual. I think ritual is – we need a sacred language. We need a way to mark profound moments in every human life. We can't – when someone dies, we can't just leave the room without a word. So I think this is a challenge for secular culture to invoke ritual and to talk about even the sacred dimension of human experience in language – that doesn't entail that we lie to ourselves or to our children about the nature of reality.
Chris, we know so little. This is, I suppose, where we get into what might sound like an agnostic polemic, but it's not. Science doesn't have the answers to, what's at the bottom of the ocean. It doesn't have the answers yet to why birds migrate. I mean, I keep coming to these examples in my mind, or how emperor penguins mate, those kinds of things. Can't answer what's out in interstellar space yet. We just don't simply know.
Right. But we know how we will answer these things. We know what process of reasoning and human discourse is liable to provide an answer. And we know how to honestly represent our uncertainty in intellectual terms. And this is not a feature of religion. I mean, we can't prove the absence of God, say. We can't prove the absence of Zeus.
You can't prove a negative.
Yeah. No one's wasting any time worrying about whether Zeus is really exists and is going unpropitiated. And the God of Abraham has the same status. But one thing we can know for certain is that when you read these books that are supposedly dictated by the creator of the universe, they are highly imperfect by any variable you'd want to. I mean, these are not good books in terms of orienting your worldview in the 21st century in any deep sense.
There's a lot of ugliness, but that's true for most mythologies, really.
Yeah, but it's not just ugliness. It's these books are completely bereft of a scientific understanding of the way the world works. They support slavery, so they get the most fundamental moral moments wrong. I mean, that slavery is probably the easiest moral question we've ever had to solve, and one of the most consequential. Now every sane person repudiates it. You cannot get there reading the Bible.
But let's put the scriptures aside. Some people just have faith, and they feel, faith, whatever, can move mountains or whatever. I mean, that's not too scientific in itself, but they feel that it can make a difference. And I suppose one could argue that it has. I mean, if you look at intellectual history, civil rights movement, going back even before the abolition movement, it was really organized religion that had a lot to do with those movements and continues to do things in terms of liberation theology with the poor in South America, with the solidarity movement in Poland. These are things based on organized religion.
Well, I think there's a misleading feature here, which is that basically everyone has been religious. So you can point to anything that's happened in the past, good or bad, and say religious people did it. Basically, every bridge that has ever been built has been built by religious people. That doesn't mean we need a belief in God to build bridges. Now, the truth of abolition is that it was harmed and impeded by religion to a remarkable degree because the theology was on the side of the slaveholders. And so the fact that certain good religious people were able to ignore or cherry pick their scripture and get motivated to fight slavery and later racism, that's all to the good. But that's not – you can't really credit a biblical worldview with that behavior. I want to come back to the question you asked, though, which I think I didn't answer, which is what do we do with beliefs that seem to make people happy and seem to console them, but are either held for bad reasons or are obviously false? And I think that's not really a problem for my view of the way science and morality interact. I think that the value of holding true beliefs and the value of intellectual honesty is so clear across the board. And having your beliefs about the world actually coupled with the reality of your life is so valuable that I think we have a natural bias toward the truth. I mean, this bias is not without exception. I think we can admit that there are instances in human life where you don't want to know the whole truth, where knowing the whole truth could get you killed or could make you terribly depressed, or there's some value in being either slightly self-deceived or not having complete information.
Or even believing in something illusory. I mean, I think most skeptics would agree that astrology is a good example of that. But people believe in it, and they believe in it in extraordinary numbers.
Yeah, but there are immense harm. When you actually follow the highways and byways of delusion, you encounter horrible misuses of human energy and horrible failures of compassion, even in the context of astrology. So I think we should be very slow to think that that being confused is merely—
You don't see them insipid. As innocuous, I understand.
Yeah. And I think the instances are so few and far between where delusion is good for us that I think we should be quite skeptical of ever promulgating the idea that we should relax our hold on reality so as to be consoled. And the truth is, I think you can clearly be moral, in fact, more moral, committed merely to just motives like compassion that require no belief in the supernatural.
There are many studies that show, in fact, I think Timothy Ferris alluded to this, that agnostics and atheists and secular-minded people are actually genuinely more ethical, more often than not, to people who call themselves, you know, highly religious and that sort
of
thing.
Yeah. Well, the problem is religion gives you this ancillary motive to help that really has nothing to do with compassion. I'm not saying religious people aren't also compassionate, but which is better, to go to Africa to help the hungry and the sick because you're merely connected to the suffering of humanity, or to go because you think the creator of the universe is going to reward you for doing it?
If you had more missionaries, say, going to Africa or, you know, to try to help the poor and the starving and so forth, or people risking their lives, and like these people who were recently killed in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. facing the Taliban, even more extreme kind of religious toxicity, whatever, lethal. What's the difference, one might say? I mean, as long as they're doing good deeds.
Well, the difference is actually huge, because even in so simple an act as feeding people, right, you have Christian missionaries making their work contingent upon these people accepting Christ. You have them preaching the divinity of Jesus in areas where Christian-Muslim violence has literally killed millions. You have Catholics preaching against condom use in villages decimated by AIDS. I mean, this is stuff you would not do if you were not deluded by Iron Age metaphysics. And alongside all of these people who, granted, also do good work when they're not vitiating it with their religious bamboozlement, you have secularists like Doctors Without Borders doing the same kind of life-saving work, completely unencumbered by religious dogmatism. And so clearly intact, neurologically intact human beings can respond to this latter secular urge to just help
doctors,
people.
Somebody joins Doctors Without Borders out of, say, some sense of faith, as I think, to my knowledge, a number have, would they need to separate their faith from what they're doing if they're doing it for that reason, even though they're not there to proselytize or teach against birth control or those kinds of things?
Well, I just think this word faith is up for some scrutiny, and we should speak candidly about it, because no one is satisfied with faith. Faith is a holding pattern that smart people, in the best case, it's a holding pattern that smart people engage when they hope something is true but don't really have a good reason to believe it. And so they talk as though they can – I mean, there's an innocuous version of this. You can live as though something is true and you just don't know what the facts are, because it's kind of a good attitude to have. I mean, I don't know today is going to be a good day. I don't know I'm not going to get run over by a car. But I act as though it's a good day and I'm safe. Because it's a positive orientation toward an uncertain future. Now, that if that's faith, well, fine. Everyone needs that kind of faith. That's completely benign. But the faith that makes propositional claims about the nature of reality, the faith that Jesus was born of a virgin, say, and may be coming back, these are claims that are believed by vast numbers of people, and they are absolutely at odds with what we know to be true scientifically about the world. And you have to lie to yourself or think in a very kind of shoddy way to maintain those beliefs alongside a truly informed scientific worldview. And that's just a problem. It's a problem for education. It's a problem for divisions between people in this world because these faith claims are incompatible. And it's a problem because it forecloses our better efforts to find a rational basis for our spiritual yearnings and our ethical impulses.
Sam Harris, author of The Moral Landscape, you mentioned spiritual yearnings. Those are certainly real. In fact, even neuroscience now seems to corroborate the idea that there's some spiritual hunger in the brain or something along those lines. And in fact, I know you take on moral relativism in your book and talk about the perils of moral relativism, and certainly that's a good thing to give caveats out about. But the moral landscape changes, doesn't it? And it's changing all the time. Even through science it's changing, and because of science it's changing.
Yeah, well, maybe I should mention what I mean by the moral landscape. It's the analogy I draw giving a framework in which to think about questions of good and evil and right and wrong in universal terms so that the peaks correspond to the heights of well-being and the valleys correspond to the lowest depths of misery. And that there are different ways to think about this. The way I think about it is it doesn't change. It's just there are these possible there's frontiers.
Fluctuations, yeah. Vicissitudes, basically.
Well, there are peaks and valleys, so that there are undiscovered frontiers of human well-being that await our discovery, and we could fail to discover them. And we don't know how good it could be to be a human being. We don't know how good a global civilization could be, how fully it could maximize human happiness. And this awaits our discovery, and
does that include the spiritual realm, or what
yeah,
we think of
yeah.
as the spiritual realm?
It certainly includes the contemplative life and the kinds of experiences that mystics and spiritual people and yogis have had for millennia. But the question is, how should we think about that? I mean, all of those experiences attest not to the perfection of the Bible or to the reality of the God of Abraham. They attest to the possible range of positive and transformative human experience.
And to flourish more is how you put it, right?
Yeah, but flourish very much in many cases in the sense in which contemplatives and mystics and yogis have described. I think self-transcendence and rapture and ecstasy and awe, these are features of the human mind which can be discovered to a greater or lesser degree by people making the right efforts, in this case, at introspection. And I think that's a fascinating area of research, both personally and scientifically. And it has a lot to do with the connection between introspection and living a good life.
We're coming up on a break. We're talking to Sam Harris again. His new book is The Moral Landscape. And you can join us in this conversation. In fact, we invite you to do so. He'll appear, by the way, tonight, 7:30 at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley as part of the Berkeley Arts and Letters series. Join us now if you care to. It's 866-733-6786. That's our toll-free number. Welcome aboard if you want to join the conversation. 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Sam Harris has a new book out. His book is called The Moral Landscape, and the subtitle is How Science Can Determine Human Values. And again, he'll be at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley this evening at 7:30. His other books include The End of Faith and Letters to a Christian Nation, and he's CEO of Project Reason, a nonprofit foundation devoted to spreading scientific knowledge and secular values in society. Where is the part in all of this, Sam, for irrationality, what D.H. Lawrence called speaking with the blood, the kind of passions that have nothing to do with reason, for example?
Right, right. Well, I think those are often oversold. You know, you get, as a non-believer criticizing faith, one of the challenges you get is, well, prove you love your wife. You know, you can't prove love, say. Love is irrational. Well, love is not irrational in the sense that religious faith is irrational. Love is not dogmatic. Love is, I mean, there's clearly more to life than merely understanding the universe. And any sane scientist would acknowledge that. And it's not a matter – I mean, we prove our love for one another every day, and we know what we mean by love. It entails behavior. It entails a certain subjective feeling. It entails having the right look on your face at the right moment. I mean, there are features of love that if a person doesn't display them, their claims to love are obviously specious.
But, you know, my literary mind's going to a story which you may know, Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. Uh-huh. And there's a guy in that story who is ready to kill himself and his beloved, and the woman is defending this as showing how much he really loved her.
Okay, well there are pathological.
Well, there's a whole continuum of what we mean by love. Yeah. I guess is really what I'm saying, and it's a subjective phenomenon to a great degree. I'm just wondering how we can quantify these things as we learn more from the Genome Project. Maybe it'll give us more knowledge on that front, but you know, I think the
point of contact between science and these subjective states is more likely to be neuroscience and neuroimaging and psychology, and these branches of science can tell us a lot about our inner life that we don't notice. There's no question that we can be self-deceived. We can use words in the wrong way. We can fail to remember what it was like to be ourselves a moment ago or a day ago or a year ago, and be wrong about the way we summarize our experience to ourselves. And we're each telling ourselves a story of our life every moment in our discursive thinking, which can be quite confabulatory and at odds with what is actually going on. And you know this, I'm sure, that rather often people are more aware of our own emotional life than we are. I mean, you can be more aware of my emotions right now in certain instances than by just looking at my face than I can be. You know, you're noticing my tone of voice perhaps better than I am in certain moments. We are in an intersubjective world, and a world of in which mind is emerging from the behavior of the human brain. As a matter of neurophysiology, and there's a wilderness of detail there to be studied. But none of this negates the importance of our inner lives and our subjective experience. I mean, what we want, consciousness is all that we can care about. Consciousness and its states is the point. But the possibilities of conscious experience can be talked about and thought about with greater or lesser precision and honesty. And that's something we I think can never forget.
Well, we're going to go to our listeners and bring them in this conversation. Just since you mentioned love, though, I think, in fact, I'm sure it was Freud who defined love as temporary insanity. But he was talking about, you know, the whole maybe act of falling in love. But things wash over you, endorphins and all kinds mm-hmm. of endocrine changes and endorphin changes and all the likes of that. And that can bring on all kinds of irrationality. I mean, we know that. And it's hard sometimes to track because the subjective responses are so different.
Yeah, well, in that case, you're talking about irrationality that is, in retrospect, something that people often regret. So it's you're moved based on desire. And again, we use this word love to cover a large spectrum of fixation and fascination and no doubt at the level of the brain and even at the level of a kind of clear introspection, there are many different bands in this spectrum that we should separate conceptually. And some of what people mean by love is just completely egocentric craving, and it shouldn't be dignified in the same way that a true connection and commitment to another person's happiness is. When we
refer
to that as love.
When people speak to you about spiritual love, do you recoil or how do you respond?
No. I think spirituality and mysticism are words that we don't have good secular synonyms for. So they come to us trailing a tremendous amount of metaphysical debris that we shouldn't want to embrace. But I use words like spirituality and mysticism to describe these deeper self-transcending experiences that people can clearly have when they meditate or pray or
I think you're right. We're semantic paupers in that area, aren't we? I mean, because we know so little really about what's going on.
Well, no, it's not. But we.
I mean,
know.
We've tested mystics, and people who put on robes into bed, and they are able to warm their body just through their consciousness and that sort of thing. I mean, these are fascinating kinds of things in terms of holistic and the like. But what I mean by that is there are certain things that remain impenetrable to us.
Well, no, but the, you know, I would invite anyone to go sit a 10-day meditation retreat in silence and explore that methodology of introspection. I mean, you, in 10 days, you can have a rather remarkable experience of witnessing the flow of your own conscious experience in a way that you never have and will never have but for that effort. And it's a remarkable thing to do. And to even in that short a space, it does confirm many of the claims of contemplatives over the centuries.
And mystics even, too.
Yeah.
Let me bring our callers in, and we'll go first to Pedro. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning, this is Sam Harris. I read both of your books, Letter to the Christian Nation and The End of Faith, and I think I enjoyed them both, although sometimes I felt like you contradicted yourself a little bit on some of the points, but I enjoyed them both. As a matter of fact, I'm beginning to practice something you mentioned on the last chapter of your book, The End of Faith, about what you were talking about right now. It's meditating, some introspective, and trying to live in the moment. And I found them both interesting. But my question that I had this morning was, you were talking about earlier about subjective words, you know, things like good and bad and truth can be subjective. And I had a question about where does this where does this originate from? I mean, your idea, I believe that what you talk about faith being bad for people, is I believe that you mean it because you want something good for them. You want them to experience what not having faith and maybe substituting that for something else, like you were talking about right now, meditation. Mm. Whereas some people that have faith believe that you would be better off believing and having faith, and they do it out of that good reason, for a good reason, just as you, I believe, do it for a good reason, that you want people to question their faith and to try to find something more scientific to identify. So I was wondering, where does this originate from? Where, how can we tell, is there an absolute truth, is there an absolute good and an absolute bad?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think this... there clearly is something that we want to refer to by words like truth and fact. I mean, there are – reality is a certain way. It has a certain character whether or not we understand it. And there are infinite number of questions we can ask about the nature of the world, which we will never answer, but we know they have answers because we know we live in that sort of world. So if I were to ask how many birds are in flight over the surface of the earth at this moment – we know that question has an answer, and yet we know we're never going to answer it, and it just changed a second ago. So there are an infinite number of questions like that, and there are questions like that about the possibilities of human experience. We have an opportunity in this world to be as happy and as cooperative with one another as we can be, and the possibilities there clearly are constrained by science at every level, genetics and neurobiology and psychology and sociology and economics. Everything that can possibly influence states of the human brain is relevant here. And so what I'm arguing in my book is that it is a myth that science can't tell us about human values, because human values have to depend upon the possible flourishing of conscious creatures. And this flourishing is completely dependent upon the nature of reality and the laws of nature. And so we just have to honestly talk about the situation we are in. And I just think that while delusion can be occasionally useful, generally knowing how the universe works is going to pay far greater dividends to us. And we know this with respect to human health, and we should know it with respect to psychological health and the health of societies.
What about the opening of, bottles perhaps that shouldn't be open, like the nuclear bottle, the result mm-hmm. of scientific investigation leads us into discovering nuclear fission, and that leads us into nuclear weapons, and here we are, you know, in a situation where we could annihilate ourselves. And there's also, of course, that great indictment of science being too dissociated in some of its methodology from the human realm.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think that's fair. But notice that's not it's completely true that there are facts that would be better not to know, and there are avenues in science that we don't want to go down. And it can be very difficult to see those with foresight.
Unless you have a periscope.
Yeah. I mean, we see those sort of after the fact. But we, in science, we are not committed to the completely uncontained discovery of more information and its dissemination. I mean, if we were, we would just want to teach everyone how to synthesize smallpox. You know, we would publish that on the recipe on the sides of buses. You know, there's no reason to do that and there are obvious reasons not to do that. And if we could uninvent certain kinds of knowledge, there would be an argument for doing so. The problem is we can't do that. And the only corrective to those unfortunate consequences is better science and scientific remedies for problems that science has inadvertently produced, and an awareness that we should be pursuing knowledge for the purpose of human flourishing.
Let me go to more of our callers, and we'll go next to you, Anne in Daly City. Good morning.
Good morning. My problem with Sam Harris does not come for religion, because I'm myself not a very faithful or mystical person. But I am a historian, and both what he said now and what was said on Science Friday have problems in that I think he's grossly distorting the historical record, and he misrepresents what some religions even teach. On Science Friday, someone suggested that the Catholic Church was more concerned about contraception than rape.
Sam said that in print, by the way.
That's a fact. I mean, I can tell you why I said that, and please feel free to point out my errors. But if this is an error, let me disagree, because what I said is that the moment you see that morality has to be linked to questions of human flourishing, then you can see that many religious moralities fail that test and shouldn't be taken seriously. And I cited as an example that the Catholic Church, as a matter of its doctrine and a matter of its daily effort as an institution, is more committed to stopping contraception than stopping the rape of children. Now, that is a fact that awaits the attention of anyone who wants to look at the horrible legacy of child rape in the Catholic Church and the efforts that the Church has taken as an institution to conceal it. It's also obvious, given the fact that they excommunicate anyone who preaches about contraception in its favor, and never excommunicate people who rape children in the church. They're more concerned. I would add another crime to their history here. They're more concerned about stopping gay marriage than genocide, and they will reliably excommunicate anyone who preaches in favor of gay marriage. They will not. They did not excommunicate a single member of the Third Reich for the crime of genocide. They excommunicated Joseph Goebbels for marrying a Protestant. I mean, this is a deranged inversion of priorities if human flourishing is your purpose. And so I'm not saying Catholics haven't done wonderful things in the world, but the dogmatism of the institution is, I think, something I'm fairly representing as in terms of its commitment.
Anne, you had a response, or you had something else to add?
Well, I had something else to add, but you first have to get the doctrine right. There's a problem with, you know, what churches actually concentrate on, but you can't assume from that follows from their doctrine. That may have to do with all sorts of things, like what they feel they actually have control over. The Catholic Church in the modern world basically, you know, only can excommunicate people who are actually communicating Catholics in the first place, and a lot of Nazis weren't.
No, most certainly were. And
excuse me, a lot of Nazis were not members. I didn't say none were. I said a lot were not. Now, as far as the extent of genocide and so forth and so on, again, you're misrepresenting history. The Holocaust type thing, you know, actual practices began to kick in 1941. It's my turn now. And much of it was covered up until, you know, the extent of it was not, in other words, known until after the war. And of course, by then, the church, you know, it can't ex post facto excommunicate people. But I have a different point about slavery. again, these words like support fails to take into account the difference between things like condone and support. Now, the Bible was written in ancient times, the Quran was written in medieval times, and both condone or accept slavery in the sense that the people who wrote at the time just assume it was an inevitable aspect of the ancient and medieval economies. But that's not the same as saying that one has to have slavery, i.e. one can't do without it, as one, a Catholic, might say. One would have to take communion once in one's life to be considered a Christian or something. A Catholic would never say one has to practice slavery, and in fact, many Catholics never did. No.
And let me get a response to the premise you just said about slavery from Sam Harris.
Okay, well, as you imagine, I've had this conversation before, and I'm very careful with my words. And the Bible, if you believe that the Bible was written by the creator of the universe and therefore is more pregnant with moral wisdom than any other document on earth, then you have to take it seriously as a guide on that front, as most religious people, most Christians and Jews claim to. The problem is that it supports slavery. The God of Abraham never conceives of a human future in which slavery is abolished, and he simply tells us how to keep slaves. He tells us not to beat them too severely so that we knock out their eyes or their teeth, because then we have to set them free. Paul tells slaves to serve their masters well and serve their Christian masters especially well. So it's, you have it both in the Old and New Testament, and this is a problem, because this is slavery is it was an abomination, and we were right to get rid of it. And we got rid of it clearly based on a larger conversation about how human beings can thrive in this world and what it means to be a human being.
I'm going to thank Ann for the call, because in the interest of time, I want to get more of callers on here. And Pat, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Hey, Sam. You put great good sense. It's good to hear it. And well-reasoned logic. And a calm state of mind. I mean, almost all these things are absent from religious folks. But the issue of evolution for me is that if we really believe that the human organism is the product of natural selection, very random, then if that mind, how can that mind conceive of a God that preternaturally exists? That's right. Just one comment. And the second one is, Michael's comment about the things that we don't know. We will always not know things. And the more we learn, in a way, the more we learn we don't know. And I don't see that as a counter-argument whatsoever.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank
you for the call. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you for that comment. Actually, I want to address a slightly different question, because I think it's crucial. It's often misunderstood how science can inform morality, because we think that the only possible contact between science and our moral reasoning is an evolutionary account of how we got here. So most scientists studying morality look at what people do in the name of morality. They look at it, at the similarities and the differences across culture, and they tell an evolutionary story about social emotions like compassion and morally salient emotions like disgust. We talk about things like the treatment of women and why women are often treated as property by men in cultures, and we can tell an evolutionary story about that. And then as the caller points out, there's this sense that morality and our notions of good, right and wrong, good and evil are nothing but this constellation of forces that have been, on the one hand, drummed into us by evolution. We've got this primate software running on our brains, and also modulated and invented by culture. And so how would that mix of influences could we ever have something like moral truth? Well, of course, the same thing could be said about science. I mean, our physical intuitions, our mathematical intuitions, all of that is a product of the same evolutionary history. So we must think about reality with the brains that evolution has built for us, and we do this in the context of culture. But there's a very different project open to science. We can study human well-being and study the way in which our thoughts and behaviors affect it. And we can study human well-being at every level, from genetics to economics, and talk about moral truth in the context of a rational effort to maximize human well-being. And that is an instance in which we truly have left the perch built for us by evolution, because evolution can't see most of what we care about. Evolution hasn't designed us to live fulfilling lives. It hasn't designed us to have radio programs, and certainly hasn't designed us to build a thriving global civilization. We have to do these things based on an intelligent discussion about the nature of reality and an effort to cooperate with one another in the present.
Evolution hasn't necessarily also given us all the answers, and I just wanted to say that because of the caller's second point, which is that when I say, as I have on occasion, just say, I don't know, it only recognizes, Nancy Reagan said, just say no, I say, just say, I don't know. It's only recognition of the fact that there is so much we don't know, as opposed to absolutism and dogmatism and of all varieties. Here's David, who writes, first of all, Sam Harris is a hero of mine. He has fearlessly brought logic and critical discussion to faith. Huge fan. Question. While I agree that some humans can take the path of getting spiritual fulfillment through an intellectual path versus faith, aren't some people lacking the intellect to ever understand and achieve this? More colloquially, won't the dumber humans among us forever gravitate toward faith and use it as a rationale for bad acts, no matter how much we discuss this? Or he might add avoidance of bad acts, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm not very quick to kind of bound the cognitive horizons of our fellow human beings. I think the problem is much more at the level of what we tell children about the nature of reality. I mean, we just think of how utterly human life could be transformed in a single generation if we didn't preach divisive nonsense to the next generation of children. I mean, Islam and Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism, they would be completely nullified, and everything would be – if everything was taught the way we teach the myths of Mount Olympus, these traditions would be gone, and we'd live in a single world united by a common purpose of figuring out how to talk honestly about the nature of reality. That would be so easy to achieve, and it's not dependent upon having a species of geniuses.
Can we go through some emails here? We got a lot of emails that raise, I think, good questions. Here's Jeffrey, who says, I'm a physicist and an engineer and a Christian. I respectfully disagree with Mr. Harris. That there are religions which have committed horrible acts in the name of sustaining their religious framework is clear. That there are non-religious groups which have done the same or worse, communism under Stalin, Mao Zedong, is equally true. Surely communist states are the ultimate in logical, non-faith-based thinking. Your requirement that faith reveal itself to you in an objective sense is a requirement similar to proving that love exists. But there is a recognition that when one person loves another, there are actions that reveal that love. And while you can point to religions that have done damage to people, you can also point to people of faith, and I mean faith not in written texts, but faith in God, who have done great works. I note that you claim that some people claiming faith cherry-pick from the Bible to determine their faith, but aren't you doing the same? You reject the bad things that religion has done, and then reject the possibility that some people of faith have been motivated through their experience of God to do good works.
Well, I don't reject that latter possibility. Clearly, people have been motivated by faith to do good works. What I'm saying is that there are better motivations. In every case you can give me of someone being motivated by their faith, I could find you a motivation that doesn't rely on self-deception or irrational claims about the nature of reality to do that same thing.
Have you read The Grand Inquisitor? I mentioned Dostoevsky before. There is this sense that sometimes the masses need that kind of faith.
Well, what faith? It used to be that the masses,
even if it's communism, you know, right, that's the kind of, like the caller, I mean, like this emailer points out, that's the kind of faith in dialectical materialism.
Right.
Well,
but
it's faith.
Yeah. Well, that I should address that point. That the old canard about secularism having a greater body count because you have communism and the Khmer Rouge. And, I mean, these were political religions. I mean, Nazism, communism, what's going on in North Korea right now, these have all of the features of religious personality cults, and all of the terrifying features. And these were not situations in which people demanded too much evidence for their core beliefs. And the problem with North Korea is not its skepticism of the supernatural. It has created a cargo cult armed with nuclear weapons. I mean, they worship their dear leader. They think that our food offerings that come to them are devotional offerings to his genius.
But this is universal. I mean, this desire to have an iconic figure or God in the sky, what Richard Dawkins calls, you know, the alpha male or whatever you want to call it, seems to be universal, and one might even attribute it to something in our neuroscience or in our evolution.
Well, it's not universal in that it's quickly ushered out of existence the moment you get
enlightenment.
Well, look at Western Europe, and the top 20 industrialized societies. Among the top 20, only the United States and Ireland are conspicuously religious. Things are not looking good. If we have material progress, things are not looking good for this kind of faith. But another point is that you could have said that witchcraft is a human universal. It's been in every culture we can name. It still thrives in Africa. Witchcraft is obviously in disrepute in the developed world, and for good reason. But 100 years ago, you have kind of a thriving commerce in witchcraft and even in the West.
Since you like to point out things in Scripture that don't make much sense, it does say, I think, in Leviticus, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live."
Right. But witchcraft, the magical beliefs, especially with regard to human health, and are predicated on a rather stark ignorance about how people get sick and why people die, ignorance is not our friend across the board, and religion partakes of it.
Well, there's a good axiom to end with. Ignorance is not our friend. Sam Harris, delight to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for a good conversation. The Moral Landscape is the book, How Science Can Determine Human Values. He'll be at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley tonight as part of the Berkeley Arts and Lectures Series at 7:30. Thank you for listening. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour of repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.